Good evening. My name is Mike Murley, and welcome to WPKN's Mic Check, coming to you on WPKN every Sunday at 5:30 p.m. Welcome to everyone listening at 89.5 FM on your radio dial. Welcome to everyone streaming live or tuning into our podcast at WPKN.org. Each week on Mic Check, one of our hosts examines global, national, and regional issues and their effect on our local community. And just as the phrase mic check was used to mobilize people to create a human microphone during the Occupy movement and others, this weekly program seeks to amplify our community's many voices and bring them to the airwaves. Mic Check is followed on WPKN at 6 p.m. by another public affairs program, the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Thank you so much for tuning in and for joining us. My name is Mike Murley, and tonight I am honored to welcome back to the program Stanley Heller of Promoting Enduring Peace and Middle East Crisis Committee. Stan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. It's always great to have you on the show, Stan, so I appreciate you being on the show tonight.
Very good.
And as usual, we have quite a bit to talk about. So, we're going to touch on a few different topics tonight. So, first, Stan, you have a new article out on one of several websites that you're involved with, which is called Economic Uprising, and the article is called "Needed: A Guaranteed Federal Job for All Unemployed."
Right.
Can you talk about this new article, Stan, and what exactly it is that you're proposing?
Well, things are not getting much better. Jobs have gone up by over a million, but we're in such a deep hole that things are bad for so many people. There's still something like 30 million people getting some kind of unemployment benefit. And the monthly job gains are actually slowing. There were, I think, 4 million a couple months ago and, you know, a million last month. And so many are involved because of the pandemic in these jobs that we don't know if they're going to exist, like theater. You know, that requires a big crowd, an audience, people close together applauding and so on. We don't know if that's going to come back. What about all the actors and all the people involved with that? Restaurants, you know, they're experimenting with, you know, restaurants and just a few tables being served at a time, big distances. I wish them luck, but can they all stay in business that way? I mean, you know, lots of restaurants barely make it, and if they have such fewer tables available, certainly many, many are going to go under. So things are not going well. And then we had the government's temporary fix. Economists call it the helicopter drops of money. I mean, basically, it just threw out money and kept things going. So they gave $1,200 per person and lesser for children, gave it to the adults. And then they had a supplement for unemployment of $600. But that's gone. Those programs have ended, and Congress and Trump can't agree on any new ones. He's put in by executive order somehow a program that will amount to $300 a week for unemployment and extra payments, but it's a fixed amount of money, so it's only going to last for about 5 or 6 weeks. So things are pretty bad. And then there's the whole business of evictions. I mean, the figures that were projected was incredible. 40 million people at risk for being evicted by January 1st if the government didn't step in. Now, the government did step in and said, all right, we'll have more of a moratorium. Nobody can be evicted till, I think, end of December. But a moratorium doesn't mean that you don't have to pay. It means that you owe it. And, you know, a lot of people are doing whatever they can to keep current on their rent, but others are, you know, owing it, paying their food bills first, and come January, they're going to just owe a fortune. So there's a whole big, you know, mess out there. And I say, you know, there ought to be a federal guarantee, a job for anybody who needs one. I mean, it's obvious the government has trillions that it can commit to things. I forget what the number is, but they committed like $5 trillion in 2 months, you know, much, much more than they did in the Great Recession. So here they have enormous resources, and they literally print the money so they could hire people and they could have a guarantee. And there's a precedent for some of it that we had in the Great Depression. And I could talk about that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, could you elaborate on that precedent or the that example from history?
Right. Well, with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when he came in, he was no radical, but the measures that they first adopted didn't really get very far, and so they pretty much made the government an employer of last resort and started all kinds of programs. The Works Progress Administration, they put 3 million people on the payroll, and they were they were the people who couldn't find work, you know, singers, dancers. There was a theater, there was a federal theater that went on for a number of years. They had poets, they had painters. They employed people to go down south and record the folk songs of the people. I mean, all kinds of incredible government jobs. 3 million people doing that work. They had the CCC. I forget what that stands for. Conservation, I think, is in there. And they reforested land. They built national parks. They drained swamps. I talked to some guys who, they would go out and they wouldn't see their families for months at a time, and they would go out into the wilderness and do these things to help out the country. And there's a professor, Richard Wolff, who taught at Yale and UMass. He's estimated that 15 million people were employed by the federal government at one point or another in the 30s. So we should do that now. Unfortunately, Trump and Obama have gone the other way. There's in July anyway, there was a million and a half fewer state and federal jobs. And if I recall, under Obama, his cure for the Great Recession was not to employ people, and there was, I think, 500,000 less federal jobs. And I think that's, I think that's something that has to be addressed now. I think the job situation's going to be worse. There's an economist named Rubini, who's from NYU, who talks about a greater depression coming. You know, where Trump talks about a V. You know, whoa, we cratered, now we're shooting up like a rocket, he says. But Rubini says it's more like a U. It'll come up some, and then he sees all kinds of things that are permanently changing. That's going to cause real problems for people, like the opposite of globalization. Instead of sending jobs overseas, it's going to be done domestically because now people are afraid of getting stuff from overseas. But that's not going to get more people employed. They're going to robots. The National Geographic had a big article last month about how all kinds of robots are doing all kinds of work. And Rubini said, he was exaggerating. He said, pretty soon a factory is going to be all robots and one guy sweeping the floor. And eventually he'll be eliminated by the Roomba. But he sees all kinds of factors that are, going to lead to more and more exploitation of workers. Or, a lot of the rehiring is not a rehiring to a permanent job. It's to a gig job. It's, you come in for a certain number of hours, you're fighting all these other workers who want hours, and, if we need you, we'll give you the hours. If we don't, goodbye, Charlie. And so it's going to be rough out there. An alternative would be to have the government, the federal government, employ people and, doing all kinds of productive labor and particularly, certainly with the green aspect of things we are facing now. It's 2020. We have less than 10 years to settle the incredibly grave problems of environment. And the scientists keep saying you go over 2030 and you go over these points where you may not be able to come back, no matter what you do, because there'll be so much carbon in the air. And, you know, they know what to do. They know how to go to, you know, all electric and using tidal energy and wind power and so on and so forth. The technology is known. It's just they have to fight the energy companies. We actually still spend billions, tens of billions, to subsidize oil companies to help them find oil, even though we have five times more than we could possibly use safely. So I think that's something that Biden should be pressed on. Of course, you know, it's not going to go anywhere with Trump, but Biden, who looks like he'll be the nominee for the Democrats, he should be pressed on trying to get to demand federal employment. You know, back in 48, they passed the Full Employment Act, 1948, 72 years ago, which said it's the government policy that there will be full employment. And they all, you know, give lip service to that, but they don't do it. Well, you know, it should be an obligation of the government that if the private sector can't do it, then the public sector could do it.
Yes, thank you, Stan. Thank you for that. And it's essentially the way you wrote the article was very nice. And it seems like one of your, to synthesize it, I guess, or one of the main points that seemed to come to the surface for me was that a lot of these, you know, it's been a lot of sort of temporary solutions or temporary band-aids and quick fixes from the government that are just these small temporary things. Like you mentioned, the moratorium on evictions, and the stimulus and some of these other, or the, you know, these little helicopter drops of money, you know, and these stimulus programs that have expired, very temporary band-aid quick fixes as opposed to something that's more of a long-term solution, or could be a long-term solution or approach to this this crisis
so
that we're in.
I write about these kind of things on economicuprising.com, doing it, well, I don't know, I think from 2011. And I think I try to put it the language of the site in plain language. You know, economics can be very dry and very hard to understand, but I'm not an economist, but I think I can read it and understand a lot of it. And so I simplify the language, not the truth, but I hope I do a good job on it. And people can look at that at that site.
Definitely. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Mic Check on 89.5 FM, WPKN in Bridgeport, independent community radio broadcasting from the campus of the University of Bridgeport, serving Fairfield, New Haven, and Litchfield counties in Connecticut, and Suffolk County in New York's Long Island. We stream around the world at WPKN.org, TuneIn Radio, and our app, WPKN Live. And via your smart speakers as well, just tell Siri or Alexa to play WPKN Radio, as well as all of our podcasts, of which there are hundreds. You can find those at WPKN.org as well. So, Stan, shifting gears just a little bit now, Alan Dershowitz, who was a high-level position, or, you know, held a high-level position at Harvard Law School,
right,
is celebrating his 82nd birthday around this time. And he's also someone who is a outspoken supporter of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And so recently, Jewish Voice for Peace announced that they are doing something to in their own way, commemorate this occasion. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right, yeah. His name came up when I saw their email. They're not honoring him. He would be the most against the Jewish Voice for Peace, because they're for peace and against apartheid. But it's kind of a joke. They're saying, oh, in honor of his 82nd birthday, give us money, which would be a fine thing to do. Dershowitz, a long career, a young aggressive lawyer, part of the appeals for O.J. Simpson. He was one of the lawyers representing a man named Donald Trump during the impeachment trial, which everybody seems to have forgotten. But he was one of the aggressive people there who made this kind of incredible statement that as long as the president did something in furtherance of his political campaign and thought it was for the interest of the country, it couldn't be impeachable. So, you know, no matter what he did in Ukraine and so on. But I don't want to get into that. But, Dershowitz is a 200% supporter of Israeli government and its apartheid measures and so on, and has written numbers of books defending them. And I'm thinking about our TV show, a different group that I work for, the Middle East Crisis Committee, and it has a show called The Struggle on 30 cable stations and on the internet at thestruggle.com. Anyway, we said, hey, we had this interaction with Mr. Dershowitz, so we looked it up. It's back in 2007, 13 years ago. We saw that he was speaking at the at the Yale Law School in New Haven. So we put up a picket line. Just that week or a week before, he had said that there ought to be a torture warrant. You ought to be able to go to a judge and ask for permission to torture. Incredible. So that was one of the signs. Another thing he had said was that Israel's human rights record was, quote, generally superb, unquote. This in contrast to almost any human rights organization that would say their record was absolutely miserable. So we picketed him for a while, and then he came out. And we have this on one of our shows, a recent show. It's, I guess, about 2 weeks ago, that you could see on our website. And he comes out in his arrogance, and he says, give me a few minutes. I'll explain all this and settle this all for you. You're making a mistake here, and then you can talk. So we got quiet, and we listened to him. He said, 5 minutes. 5 minutes go by. 10 minutes go by. You know, who knows how long he spoke. 15 minutes. And then we're getting a little restive. You know, our purpose is to educate the public, not listen to him. And so finally, you know, people started asking questions. Let us talk. Now, we had with us Mazen Kumsia, who was head of the cytogenics department at Yale Medical School, and a Palestinian who had written several books about the Palestinian human rights situation, a real expert. And I said, now we'll have, and he takes off. And we said, hey, you are going to give one of us the right. He says, you could say anything you want. I don't have to listen. So he gets up on the, he says, you don't have anybody of the stature to talk to me. And I said, people of your stature are in The Hague. Making reference to the law, the human rights war crimes trials at The Hague. At any rate, then he went back inside and gave his talk there. And as he went inside, listened to his whole spiel, and then did give a question in the Q&A after it. But I think people would get a kick out of seeing this thing that happened in 2007. If they go to thestruggle.org and scroll down a couple inches, they'll see Dershowitz's face and some picket signs, and that's the show that's in.
Yeah, and once again, that's thestruggle.org.
Right.
So, thank you. Thank you, Stan. And then, you know, also on the topic of Israel, recently Israel engaged in a two-week-long bombing campaign against Gaza.
That's right.
And can you talk a little bit about this most recent act of aggression by Israel?
I mean, really disgraceful that the major media has barely talked about it. And, but it went on a long time, terrifying people, hurting people. There was good demonstration against it in Manchester, but not Manchester, Connecticut. It was Manchester in Great Britain. We have that on one of our shows. You know, presumably, you know, whenever you read it in the corporate press, it says it's in retaliation. Must be like a law of the editors. Everything is done in retaliation. I mean, what, you know, what people are saying is, you know, it's horrible to live here. We have just, you know, 4 hours of electricity. You don't know when it's going to come on. You know, things are terrible. Now they're starting to suffer from COVID. They kept it off for a long time. So I guess some of the people, maybe Hamas, put these balloons that have something that goes into flame. I don't know what it is, a firecracker or something. And it, you know, it hit some Israeli fields and it caused some damage. And then, you know, rather than try to say, well, maybe we ought to deal with this thing and try to settle things, no, they just bombed them, you know. This is our retaliation. So that went on for quite some time. I don't even know if it stopped now. But it is such a disaster what is going on there with by that I mean the U.S. government, our cooperation in that. So we have that in also on a show in thestruggle.org.
And Stan, we just have about 8 minutes left or so. Mm. So before we close out, I wanted to get to, there's an annual event that one of the main organizations that you're involved with, Promoting Enduring Peace, has an annual event each year called the Gandhi Peace Awards. And so, of course, it's falling during the pandemic this year. And so I know it'll be a virtual event this year. But, you know, each year with the Gandhi Peace Award, it's awarded to an individual or several people for their work in the area of peace, justice, and human rights. And so this one, again, it'll be virtual, happening in the middle of November. Can you talk about who this year's recipients of the Gandhi Peace Award will be and why they were chosen?
Right. We want to do something about Syria. And, you know, I think we announced the awardees in March, and we hoped against hope that this pandemic would clear up and we could have the event physically, but we want to have it anyway. So we will have it on Zoom or something like that. Maysoon al-Misri was chosen. She's active in the White Helmets, and these are the people who formed when Assad and then later the Russians were bombing in Syria, and they would, you know, rescue people from the craters and take out the corpses and so on. And I don't think that bothered the Syrian regime very much, but they also had the absolute gall to take pictures and video of what had happened and showed it all over the world, and that made the regime and its defenders furious. So, I mean, they do incredible work, saving so many lives. And now there's still some bombing, but I guess the main thing they're doing is COVID work, a place where they're incredibly underserved by medical personnel, and so they go around and educate and help out on that. The second person is Zaid Sahlul. I just butchered his name. Sahlul. He's a doctor. He lives in Chicago. He's Syrian-American. He headed formerly SAMS, Syrian-American Medical Society, and now he works for Med Global, which not only deals with Syria, but with 15 other countries, and is done some incredible work getting money and supplies in for hospitals and so on. And then he, besides that, he has his regular job, and he's involved, I think, in pulmonary work. Well, that's COVID-19, and so he's been... I can't imagine how many hours he's been working on that, and he caught it at some point. He didn't say anything about it online, you know, Facebook, until, I think I'm recovered enough that I can write some more on Facebook. Wow, you know, he had it, and he got through it, and now he's, you know, back in the hospital at work. So these are people who... need to be honored, and they stand for all the medical and rescue workers that have done great work in Syria against during this terrible situation. Saluo has been talking about COVID now, in not only in the little part that is not under Assad control, but under most of Syria. And, you know, it's sort of being kept under wraps, but evidently there's a lot of COVID infection all over Syria. So he's trying to work on that, you know, even with these people he had never worked with in years and years, to help them out. So quite an amazing person. So we're trying to bring this issue up on Syria and promoting enduring peace. So the middle of November, so it's more than 2 months away. So we'll be advertising that as time goes by. And currently we've been talking about nuclear issues. You know, August is the month of that we remember what happened to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And just around that time, you had this incredible accident in Lebanon. Or we don't know the full circumstances, but something went off in Beirut, and certainly there was this incredible negligence of this immense tonnage of ammonium nitrate they were storing, because somebody didn't pay some fee years ago. I think it goes back to 2014. Anyway, the whole thing blows up. Something like 250,000 people lose their homes. We mentioned that as a horror, but the bigger negligence is nuclear weapons. I mean, one of these goes off, you know. And nobody's talking about it. Obama spent, $10 billion to modernize the program. Trump asked in the beginning of the administration, well, we have these things. Why can't we use them? I mean, wow, you know. So that's certainly the biggest negligence, possessing these things. There's even a treaty that was agreed upon, I forget by how many nations, that said possession of nuclear weapons is a war crime. Unfortunately, none of the nuclear powers agreed to this thing, and it's kind of a dead letter, but it's certainly a big issue, and people can read about it on our site, peepeace.org.
Definitely. Definitely a big issue, and I, as always, wish we had more time, Stan. So we are running out of time. We have just about a minute left. Mm-hmm. How can our listeners learn more about Economic Uprising, the Gandhi Peace Awards, and the other work you're involved in?
Okay, so Economic Uprising. .com. For the TV show, thestruggle.org. And PE Peace has a couple websites, peepeace.org and peacenews.org.
Stanley Heller of Promoting Enduring Peace and Middle East Crisis Committee, thank you so much for joining me once again on Mic Check.
And thank you.
My pleasure as always, Stan. And Stan, thank you as always for speaking up about important issues and just for all the great work that you're doing.
I appreciate it.
Have a great night, Stan.
I will.